Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Ah, can't you see it? A sparkling roadside EV quick charge power facility. It's chargers, control panels, and switchgear powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean. We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We're now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, and he joins us every Thursday in the 12 o'clock hour, and we appreciate same. Rafi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Neil. Great to be back on. I just wish that we could find something to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have something very important to talk about. We are moving forward as it relates to the consent decree, and we've now entered the sustainment period. If you would, give us a backdrop of this as we got to this point and how important this is for the NOPD.
Well, I mean, this is a real accomplishment, a real milestone. But again, there's still some politics and gamesmanship that's going on the part of the city. But, you know, this consent decree was the result of the federal government conducting an investigation of the New Orleans Police Department post-Katrina. And in 2011, the government issued a report documenting that the NOPD was engaging in a pattern and practice of use of excessive force, unconstitutional stop searches and seizures, and discriminatory policing. Mitch Landrieu entered into the consent decree, and the consent decree started in January of 2013. So we're looking at a dozen years ago that this consent decree officially started. And during that dozen years, the police department had to basically change its culture. So prior to the consent decree, the department had rules, policies, and procedures that prohibited and were supposed to prevent excessive force, unconstitutional stop seizures and searches, and discriminatory policing. But those policy rules and procedures weren't being followed. So what the government did was saying, listen, a city of New Orleans, if you don't clean up your act, we're going to take over the operations of the police department. And the city agreed to enter into this consent decree. And this consent decree was formalized in court. And the consent decree called for a federal monitor that independently verified the police department's compliance with all the provisions of the consent decree. So during the course of the past dozen years, there have been twists and turns. Police department made substantial advances and was close to achieving compliance in 2021 when the city decided that they were tired of the consent decree. And they filed a motion to end the consent decree. And during that 18-month period of time, the police department began to backslide. In other words, they stopped documenting and doing the things that were providing or creating the path for the police department to exit the consent decree. And these are things that departments normally do anyway to make sure that their policies, rules, and procedures were being followed on a daily basis. But when the city filed the motion to end the consent decree, the police department stopped cooperating with the federal monitor and essentially began to fall out of compliance with other components of the consent decree. And that backsliding, that decline, was really culminated with the city's botched investigation of Officer Jeffrey Vappi and the mayor of the city of New Orleans, where he was documented to have been entering the mayor's Pontabla apartment as the only member of the executive protection team given that privilege. And that investigation was conducted by Internal Affairs. And the federal monitor concluded that the investigation was botched, was incomplete, in large part because the mayor didn't want to cooperate. And the judge conducted a hearing, and the judge concluded that the police department was out of compliance with the consent decree based on that investigation. But enter Ann Kirkpatrick. Ann Kirkpatrick was hired at the end of 2023 and went into court and convinced the judge that under her leadership, the police department would once again begin to work towards the path of substantial compliance and change the way that the city had been responding to the court and complying with the consent decree over the 18 months before her arrival. And to her credit, about a year from the date that Ann Kirkpatrick came in, the court day before yesterday concluded that the police department was in fact in substantial compliance and moved the police department into the final phase. Now, the final phase, the city of New Orleans in October of 24 entered into a joint motion with the Department of Justice, acknowledging that both sides agreed that the police department should be moved into the final phase, the substantial compliance sustainment period. But the city acknowledged that there was work to be done before they would achieve substantial compliance, and that would be accomplished during the sustainment period, which began officially a day ago. So that was in October, and the judge had scheduled a hearing on Monday of this week, the 10th, and on Friday, I'm sorry, the 13th, on Friday the 10th, 3 days, it was Friday afternoon, so Saturday, Sunday, and on Monday morning, the city was supposed to go into court and present evidence as to why they should be moved into compliance. And instead, the city filed a motion to terminate the consent decree the Friday afternoon before that Monday hearing. And in that 11th hour filing, the city also asked the court to allow the Attorney General's office to engage as special counsel to the city of New Orleans. So on Monday, everybody thought the hearing was going to be about whether the department was ready to move into the sustainment period. But the hearing turned into the city requesting that the consent decree be terminated immediately. And the Attorney General's office that had previously tried to enroll in counsel and was determined by the court that they didn't have standing to enroll as counsel The judge had to deal with that. Apparently, under the city charter, the city charter requires that before a special counsel can enroll, the city council, by a two-thirds vote, has to approve the employment or engagement of any special counsel, which was not done by the mayor and the city attorney's office when they petitioned the court to allow the attorney general's office to enroll. So despite the last-minute political chicanery that erupted on Friday afternoon and carried over into Monday, that hearing went forward, and one of the most courageous things that I've seen was that the judge on the hearing on the 13th was taking comments from people, and the superintendent, Ann Kirkpatrick, walked up to the mic while the city attorney was present, arguing that the consent decree should be terminated, stated on the record that she favored entering the police department into the two-year sustainment period, which was directly in opposition to what the city of New Orleans and the mayor were requesting from the court. So on Tuesday, the judge issued her ruling, and the judge determined that the police department was going to be moved into the two-year sustainment period. And she stated on the record that the only reason that she was doing that was because she, the judge, was convinced that the superintendent and the NOPD was sincere in saying that they were going to work to achieve the substantial compliance during the final sustainment period. And that process has to be maintained over the next 12 months. And I have no doubt that the police department can and will achieve this. But I think it was just another misstep, another indication of the lack of thought and leadership provided by the mayor to on the eve of a significant accomplishment. I mean, the police department was basically drifting away from compliance before Ann Kirkpatrick arrived. And had the police department positioned to move into the final phase of the consent decree, only to see the city of New Orleans pull a surprise attack, not even speaking to the police chief, and filed this motion. And despite the city's missteps, the judge still moved the police department into the final phase, and that is a real accomplishment. It's something that, you know, it's been 12 years in the making, and I believe it would have been accomplished years ago were it not for the mayor's missteps in attempting to bypass the agreed-upon procedures in the consent decree. And she had worked towards the substantial compliance, I believe the police department would have been moved into the final phase maybe as early as 2021 instead of January of 2025.
There's not been really a recount like this in the public, I don't think, about what actually happened. This is disappointing. I mean, in what universe does the city, more importantly, Mayor LaToya Cantrell, believe that she's going to be able to bully a U.S. District Court judge appointed for life who's gone through this process this entire period of time and that she's just going to wave a magic wand and make everything go away?
Well, so I was present in court on Tuesday. The judge at the hearing on Monday the 13th indicated that she was going to issue a ruling on Tuesday the 14th. And you had four members of the city council present, most of the rank and leadership of the police department, virtually all of the media, substantial numbers of concerned and interested citizens, and absent was the mayor of the city of New Orleans. So this is something that, you know, when she was elected mayor, you know, she talked about, you know, achieving compliance and moving the police department through this process. And on the day that the court was going to issue a ruling on this, she didn't even bother showing up in court. So that, to me, is just another example of her lack of leadership, her lack of engagement. And I think that, you know, the only reason that we've been moved into these sustainment period is not because of the mayor or the efforts of the city attorney's office, because of the hard work of the men and women of the New Orleans Police Department under the leadership of Ann Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite evident. I mean, it's really the judge saying to the mayor, you have no credibility in this court. I mean, any rookie lawyer out there understands that if you don't have credibility with the judge, you're going nowhere quick. I mean, and there's been so many missteps that really set us back. And that's why I get a little bit infuriated when people are trying to castigate Ann Kirkpatrick and saying, oh, she was a DEI hire or this or otherwise. I said, no. She was the most qualified individual there, and she's proven it over and over again, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I told you when she was, you know, appointed superintendent, she went into court when the judge was considering holding the city in contempt of court for the way that they mishandled the VAPI investigation, and pledged to the court in open court that things were going to change under her leadership. She pledged her support to the consent decree in moving the department into compliance with the consent decree. And that's the only reason the city wasn't sanctioned at that time. And to her credit, despite the position of, you know, her boss, the mayor, and the city attorney and special counsel, the police chief maintained her course, maintained her promise to the court, and delivered on that promise, and had to actively announce in front of the city attorney's office that she was not supporting the position of the mayor to terminate the consent decree, but was actually suggesting to the court, and went on record as saying the police department should go into sustainment, the final phase, which is, you know, going to be 2 years through this. So, I mean, I respect Ann Kirkpatrick because she was supporting the men and women of the police department that have really toiled over the past 12 years to achieve compliance with a consent decree.
Well, let's put this in very simplistic way, Rafi. She's paid for herself, right? The money saved by restoring the credibility in that court with Judge Susie Morgan, and the reduced amounts of monies that the city has had to pay over this period of time, and now even less, she's paid for herself.
Right. So, the city's saying that the consent decree is costing too much money. Well, the final phase basically means that the federal monitor is going to play a secondary role, a minor role, compared to what the police department. The police department is basically going to document to the court that the police department is in compliance, because this phase is meant to wean the police department from the federal monitor. This is the 2 years that the police department's going to prove their ability to manage their own shop and document and their compliance with all of their policies, rules, and procedures. They're going to be collecting data and issuing quarterly and annual reports on the audits that they're conducting into all the major areas of policing. And they're going to be doing it themselves. And they've accomplished this, despite the fact that we're down almost 300 officers from what we need to police the city, and during the same time that they have achieved the substantial compliance that allowed us to move into this final phase, they've also brought down crime over the past 2 years by 50% in all four of the major violent crime categories. So it shows that if a police department is better managed and they track their own policies, rules, and procedures, not only can they practice constitutional policing, but they better protect and serve the people of this community. They've been able to do both, and do both in an outstanding fashion, even though the mayor of the city of New Orleans did not recognize that, did not acknowledge that. In fact, misstated the fact that this was impeding the police department's ability to police the city, when the police department has repeatedly proven over the past 2 years that the consent decree in no way has impeded their ability to protect and serve the people of this city, as evidenced by the crime rate that's been diminished by 50% over the past 2 years.
Absolutely. No doubt. Great information, and thank you so much for saying. We got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. When we come back, we'll get an update on the Bourbon Street attack. Stay with us.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Hey, football fans, are you obsessed with the game?
Oh, yeah.
Do you find yourself looking for breakdowns from every angle? For those who can't get enough, subscribe to Brian Baldinger's podcast, The Best Football Show, where he discusses the top teams and players from around the league each week.
That's what I watched this week, a dominant performance.
New episodes drop every weekday, including Trench Talk Tuesdays with former NFL lineman Mark Schlereth. Make sure to subscribe to The Best Football Show on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
With us. Welcome back, folks. We are visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, the Bourbon Street attack, the horrific event, it's all like in the aftermath of it, it's like a whole new life cycle of information relative to the individual responsible for same. Tell us about it.
Right. So on Tuesday of this week, the FBI released an investigative update. And in that update, it was just a little one-pager. They clarified that it wasn't 35 victims that were physically injured, but actually 57 individuals that were physically injured. Wow. During the terrorist attack. Of course, the number is the same, 14 deceased victims. And there were, according to the FBI in this press release, there were 136 victims that have been identified, including two businesses that suffered damages. So I suspect the difference between the 57 that were physically injured and the 136 victims, those are going to be people whose property was damaged as a result of the terrorist attack. So it goes on to, in this press release, the government also discloses that they've been able to document that the terrorist, Jabbar, became a devout Muslim in 2022, and in the spring of 24 began showing extremist views. So on November the 10th, he took a train from Houston to New Orleans. And while he's in the city, he began to apartment shop in the city. And the government has identified an apartment owner that he applied for an apartment with. They've interviewed him. So the government basically it's been reported that they recovered at least one of his phones and some of his computers. So they're using his phones to retrace his steps. And the government disclosed that, you know, he contacted a New Orleans apartment owner on Orleans Street and applied for to rent the apartment, but later told the apartment owner he had changed his mind. So the government, the FBI, has determined that he's conducted many online searches that included how to access a balcony on Bourbon Street, information about Mardi Gras. He researched several shootings that occurred in the city as late as mid-November. And just hours before the attack on Bourbon Street, he also searched for information about the car that rammed into the innocent victims in a Christmas market in Germany just 10 days before. So the FBI is retracing his steps. And what they disclosed is, you know, another look and realizing that this terrorist had identified New Orleans as his target. And his goal was to inflict as many mass casualties as possible. And what you're seeing is that while he decided to drive his car down Bourbon Street on New Year's morning, he was also considering renting an apartment. He was also considering trying to have access to a balcony on Bourbon Street, which means that he probably could have checked into a hotel that had access to balconies. And if he'd had done that, he elected to have done that, he could have, from the balcony, detonated bombs and opened fire on the crowd. So he was exploring what his options were, but he had clearly identified New Orleans as his target. There was some of this information indicated that he was considering Mardi Gras, he ultimately decided to drive his rental truck down Bourbon Street early on January the 1st. But he was coming to New Orleans, and he was going to kill as many people as possible. And he was looking to make a statement and for people to know who he is. And he achieved that. But what the government is doing, what the FBI is doing, is, you know, giving us a little glimpse into what he was planning. And I did a little research, and I've seen, you know, this press release acknowledges that he did some research about the Christmas market attack in Germany, where a terrorist there drove a car down the sidewalks and murdered some people. And there's been national research that shows that when a vehicle incident occurs in Europe, a terrorist vehicle, that there is a corresponding copycat response that we see in the United States. So, sure, you know, this guy began to fit into the, you know, the pattern of an extremist that the government has identified what some indicators are. And, you know, what we're seeing is that he was set on making his crime scene the city of New Orleans. And now we know that, he ultimately decided on January the 1st, but he was going to, whether it was January the 1st or Mardi Gras or some other event, it was going to be in New Orleans. This is a suicide mission. The government is continuing to do a forensic investigation to determine everything that he did. And I think that we'll be seeing, you know, more disclosures about. We haven't heard anything about what was recovered from his property in Houston, but I suspect there'll be, you know, more disclosures about what he did, who he's visited with. I suspect that the government has probably spoken to hundreds of people trying to piece together when he became a radical and what, if anything, if anyone else assisted him in any aspects of this attack. But, you know, the government obviously has access to his computers and cell phones, and that's an important tool in determining, you know, in retracing his steps and identifying if there are any other people that aided or abetted him in any aspects of this.
Absolutely. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. When we come back, we'll get an update as to Operation Sideswipe staged accidents. There was some stuff announced actually this morning. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Some recent updates relative to Operation Sideswipe stage accidents. Rafi, this case has actually been kind of moving at a really fast pace here in the last 3 weeks after kind of a lull, right, for a long period of time.
Right. So just a brief update. So this is an investigation into staged accidents that the FBI began in 2017, and the case was progressing in large part because the government had secured the cooperation of a slammer, Cornelius Garrison, that was cooperating with the government. So the slammers were the individuals that were recruiting people to falsify accidents. They would get in the car and they would actually strike the 18-wheeler and allege that the 18-wheeler struck them. That slammer would recruit people to get in the car and claim injury, and then that slammer would interface with the attorneys. So we had seen a number of people indicted and plead guilty that were recruited to get in the cars and feign injuries for a staged accident. And the slammer was the only person that could connect the staged accidents with the attorneys. The government's cooperating witness was Cornelius Garrison. So between 2017 and 2020, they were beginning to peel back the layers of the onion when in September of 2020, Garrison answered his door and someone shot him 10 times, murdering him. So the case essentially stalled from his death. And we saw some significant developments in October of last year when two people were indicted for their part in the stage accident scheme that included murdering Cornelius Garrison. So shortly after those indictments were disclosed, one of the two people, Giovanna Carter, became a cooperating government witness and pled guilty. And what happened today was the second person that was arrested in connection with the murder of Cornelius Garrison pled guilty today in a superseding bill of information acknowledging his role in the murder of Cornelius Garrison, and also identified in open court, in the government's filings in open court, they identified that another slammer by the name of, I forgot his name, but the slammer identified Sean Alfortish, a disbarred attorney, as the person that paid the other slammer to murder Cornelius Garrison. So now we know that Cornelius Garrison and Ryan Harris are, and a guy by the name of Parker, are the individuals that participated in the murder of Cornelius Garrison. And so what the government has done is they have made deals with a few members that weren't the trigger men, but were involved and privy to the plan to murder Mr. Cornelius Garrison. And now the government is going to circle and prosecute Sean Al Fortish, and Chunky Parker is the guy's name that was supposedly the trigger man and received payments from Sean Al Fortish to murder Cornelius Garrison, to silence him so that Al Fortish could not be linked to the staged accident scheme. Al Fortish had previously served time in a federal penitentiary for a fraud scheme involving the Horsemen's Association, where he diverted funds for his own personal benefit. So if he was convicted of another felony, he was looking at potentially decades in a federal penitentiary. So when Al Fortish determined that Garrison was cooperating with the government, he decided that he was going to silence him by killing him. And now the government has documented by some of the people that were involved in the plan to, and actually in the hit of Cornelius Garrison, they are now cooperating with the government, which shores up the prosecution of Sean Al Fortish and his and the person that he paid to actually pull the trigger, Chunky Parker.
This is kind of like Gangland Days stuff, right? I mean, you expect a storyline like this in a movie, not in real life.
Yeah, I mean, this is just life in the big city, where you have, you know, an individual that was given a second chance at life after he was released from the penitentiary. And because of his greed, he decided to enter into this staged accident fraud scheme. Not only was he involved in it, but his fiance, the mother of his child, has also been indicted as an attorney, as has another attorney in all of this. So sometimes there's an old saying that, you know, a prosecutor needs to make a deal with some sinners to get to the devil. And what happened in this particular case, the government made some deals with some of the lesser players in this scheme to be able to, you know, build their case and prove their case against the most culpable, the person that directed the hit and paid for the hit of a government, a cooperating federal government witness, and the person that also allegedly pulled the trigger in this. So now the government has witnesses that are filling in the blanks, and we're going to see this case take a different trajectory because of the deals that have been cut and the information that is now available to the government.
Yeah, this is not over by any stretch of the imagination, for sure. Thank you so much for that update. We truly appreciate you joining us today. Always appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
We'll be right back, folks. That's Rafi Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll check in with Ian Hoke, who's in for Scoot. Stay with us. How much time? Ian Hoke's in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
With Tim Heafy. He's the lead investigator for the House Select Committee on January 6th. We'll talk to him about that event and Charlottesville. And then we'll talk about video games for senior citizens, baby boomers, in the 3 o'clock hour with Aubrey Quinn. It's going to be a good one.
All right. Ian's up next. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. We'll see you in the morning.